Committee, I'll come to order, please. Ray, if you'd be kind enough to take a silent roll. Committee members, before we get started with our presentations this morning, Mr. Houston has given you a handout regarding some December numbers, and he would like to briefly speak to that.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Should have in front of you, it says FY 2009 State of Idaho General Fund Revenue Monitoring, and with December preliminary numbers. So we have the first 6 months of this fiscal year, total collections for the general fund of about $1.270 million, and actual collections just below that. Normally, you've probably seen I put this together with the governor's forecast. In this case, what I've done is I've compared it against last year's actual collections. So for the first 6 months, you'll see there percentage-wise, in July, we were 4.7% behind the previous year's July. August, we dropped another 3.1%, September 6.5%, October 8.4%, November 6.6%, and December 14.6% behind. Cumulatively, that takes us to 7.6% behind where we would have, if we were on course for last year's actual collections. So this will give you an idea, I think, as Kathy comes up this afternoon, or later this morning, and puts it in the budget perspective, you'll be able to get an idea of how we're tracking now versus what the revenue projections were when we set the budget.
Thank you, Ray. Senator Giddey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray, it appears then, if I'm looking at December 08 versus December 09, that we're down $105 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Giddey, that's correct. We'd be $105 million less than what we had through last December.
Thank you, Ray. Committee, our first presentation this morning is from Bob Maynard, Investment Manager for the Public Employee Retirement System. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Maynard, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members of the legislature, it is an absolute pleasure to be here this morning. It has been my honor and pleasure over the last number of years to present to this committee a capital market overview as to what the capital markets are doing and what the prospects are going forward. With me today is Michelle Sugiyama, the other investment officer for the fund. The two of us are responsible for the investment of the Percy funds. And you will see if any real question comes, I'm going to be turning to her and have her in her answer, so that's why she's here. But if there's no questions of that nature, I'm sure I can handle them. I intend to take half an hour of the time. I'm going to take about half an hour of the time to go through the capital markets, what's been going on, where we are today, and what's the likelihood of things happening in the future, and what are the prospects over the next year, and the questions that are going to determine whether or not we get out of where we are today. Obviously, there's a lot going on right now. I have been in around the capital market since the 70s. I've been actually in the investment market since the 80s. I thought when I got old and grumpy, or older and grumpier, that I'd be telling my kids or my grandkids about October of 87. No. Let me talk about September, October of 2008. This has been an absolutely, truly remarkable period. And what I'd like to do is use what I call, I've been calling, there hasn't been a name given to it yet, but I'm calling it the Great Collapse, the events between September 11th, 2008 and October of 2008. Because at that point, the financial system, the global financial system, suffered what only could be analogized to a heart attack. And what's been happening since is trying to repair that damage, and that heart attack almost immediately infected the real economy. I mean, we all have this idea, intuitively, that there's a real economy down there, and the financial system kind of floats around on top or between, but isn't really truly part of the real economy. Well, the events of the end of last year indicated, no, it was integrally entwined with the real economy. And when the financial system had the heart attack in late September, early October of last year, the patient almost died. As Mike Ferguson said yesterday, refer to the Paulson and Bernanke comments to the Congress on that weekend. If you don't do something, you may wake up on Monday morning without a financial system or an economy to try to fix. Turned out they were right. And so I want to go through that because out of that, obviously, we can't go through everything that's affecting the economy. But right now, there's a race to restart the patient before too much real damage is done. And what I'd like to do, beyond going through the events, is try to boil down the two or three major things that happened and need to happen, or the major issues that are out there so that you can play along at home as you watch people trying to figure out. Because really there's only a few really crucial elements going on here that will determine whether we get out of this or not. So, what was the great collapse? You'll see before you a chart that has three graphs on it. The Bloomberg Financial Conditions, the S&P 500, and the TED spread. And at the bottom in that chart, there is the going across the x-axis is the time. And you'll see a particular part of time outlined in orange. And that is September 11th through October 10th. You can see cliff-like falls and rises in those charts. Those are extraordinary rises and falls. Up to that point, things have been going, you know, not too badly, but not terribly. But at that point, the financial system nosedives. The top chart is an indicator by Bloomberg of financial conditions. It looks like equity, cash markets, and money markets. You can see it drop in that 1 month period of time from -2.28 to 10.1. That was the biggest drop in history. What that means is financing conditions tightened up and disappeared dramatically. Below that, I give you two other indicators that are more familiar. One is the S&P 500 during that period from September 11th to October 10th. From that period of time, it dropped 28%. If that had been a regular calendar month, like a January, a February, where people really keep good records, it would have been the biggest monthly drop since 1931. It was a huge drop in the stock market. Now, usually when the stock market drops, cash markets and bond markets go up. Not this time. The bottom one is something called the TED spread. Mike Ferguson talked about it briefly yesterday. Basically, it is an important indicator. Just to remind you, it's the three-month LIBOR rate. That's the London Interbank Offering Rate minus a three-month T-bill. Why is that important? Because it measures the risk people perceive, banks perceive, in lending to each other. How, because the T-bill is the risk-free rate, so how much more do you have to pay to borrow money if you're a money center bank? And 2 years ago, that was down to about 0.5%. Times have gotten really tight. It was 1.3% going into September 11th. After September 11th and the next month, it rose to 4.6%, which in that part of the world is stunning. It means nobody's dealing with each other. The second reason that is important is that if banks aren't lending to each other, they ain't lending to us. They're not lending to consumers. They're not lending to businesses. It's a measure of the shutdown. That basically is a measure of the shutdown of the financial system. That was the biggest rise in history. And the overnight rate actually went up to about 6 or 7%. People simply were not lending to each other because of fear and other reasons. Now, this caught everybody by surprise. Because what immediately happened is all of a sudden people's expectations on the economy. The economy immediately nosedives in concert with the financial system freezing up. This is the consensus economics estimates of 2009 nominal GDP growth. Across the bottom is the estimate during the last year of this year's economy. So in January of 08, they were all the economists, 35 of them, in this particular publication were estimating that this year's GDP would be 4.8%. And you can see they were getting a little depressed as the year went on. And then in September, they were actually getting a little more optimistic. And then all of a sudden, you had the great collapse. And immediately, they recognized that the economy itself was basically tubing. And you can see the decrease in GDP estimates immediately following, a cliff-like decline in expectations. Similarly, as you know, the capital markets really run off of corporate profits. And that's why you oftentimes will see the stock market do differently than what the general market is doing. Really, for stocks and bonds, what the capital markets care about is corporate profits. And so that really what drives, you can see in the same way, as soon as you hit October, November, December, as soon as the great collapse happened, you had everybody now expecting the economy going south. Huge change in expectations. This caught people by surprise. There is no doubt about it. And the depth of that collapse and the nature of it is something we're still working through. So what I'd like to talk about is how did we get there? How did we get here? What was the cause of this thing happening? What was the cause of the great, and I think it will be, I'll try to show you, was excess liquidity. What was the cause of the great collapse? I don't think it was inevitable, and most people now don't think it was inevitable. But Lehman bankruptcy is now seen as kind of the snowball that started that collapse. Where are we now as we stand here today? Best you can say is limbo. The situation is stabilized, but everybody's waiting. What will next year be like? Well, I can guarantee it's going to be better than last year. And that's not saying much. That's darning with faint praise. I think you will see, as I will show you, I think there is a good chance you'll have a good stock and bond market. But after what we've gone through, good doesn't get you back to even. And what is the central question for the future? The central question for the future, and the central question right now, is who's going to lend and who's going to spend? Where are the shoppers going to come from? Now, how did we get here? Well, again, basically, and I'm trying to give broad overviews, but this is 80%, 85% of it. Basically, there was a flood of liquidity in the previous years into the global financial system. Huge amounts of cash were being pumped in. And it came from basically two sources. Source number one was the central banks of the world, keeping discount rates low and kind of flooding the world with money particularly in the U.S. and Japan. Those are the two primary, but there was easy money conditions relatively worldwide. The second source was that all the savings in the world were building up, particularly in China and India. And by them keeping low current, they have to invest that somewhere. They had to invest it outside. And by keeping their currencies low, they were, in effect, lending their money to the rest of the world at extremely low rates. The combination of those two probably gave more liquidity across the world, more cash available across the world, than there had been at any time, at least in my memory, since the 20s at least. Now, in combination with all that money sloshing around, there was a movement worldwide that everybody leaped on board of the idea of letting the financial system kind of go free and innovate. So that was in combination with a kind of a deregulation or a more lightly regulated financial system. That had two big consequences. What that meant was that capital, both debt and equity, became pretty plentiful and pretty cheap. And investors, when there's low interest rates, start chasing yield. If you're used to 10% returns and bonds are giving you 6, you're going to start chasing after 6.5, 7%, things of that nature, to try to get the advantage off everybody else. And plus, with all that money and all the new institutions coming out, leverage, the ability to borrow to pay, became plentiful and easily available, and also cheap. You can borrow at 5, put in it, if you can borrow something at 5% and invest in something at 6%, and it goes up 1%, you can only make 1% on your money. But if you lever up 10 to 1, you can make 10% on your money. The leverage ratio, you simply multiply the leverage ratio by the percentage gain or loss, and that's your gain or loss. Now, the second impact, actually there were 3 impacts, was that there were some asset bubbles created, U.S. and U.K. and Spanish housing in particular. But you've already heard about the housing bubble. I'm not going to talk about that. But there was a third consequence. And this third consequence is the one that's going to have the most impact both now and going forward. The third consequence is, with all this money, with the greater deregulation and the ease of leverage, there was a shadow finance system that was dependent on short-term liquidity and lending to fund their operations that exploded. That just kind of reached into all parts of the world. What you will see is what I call the shadow finance system. There is what I call a visible finance system. What is your normal idea of where financing comes from? It's your money center banks, it's your insurance company, it's your regulated banking system. It's the things regulated by the Federal Reserve, where they have pretty tight controls and reviews. And then outside, and then you also have a public security system, New York Traded Stock Exchange, exchange-traded instruments, daily priced, publicly priced, and it's all in the open going back and forth, where the instruments are pretty much kind of the same nature. But outside of that, and there's really good information about that. It's like there's lights coming on that table right there, and you can see what's going on. But around that table, around that circle, there's kind of, think of a big spider web network, kind of going out into the darkness, where you have basically private companies that are lightly regulated, that are highly levered, that are complex and interconnected. I'm talking things like hedge funds and special investment vehicles. The main doorway into those were the investment banks. And you had private equity partnerships, you had syndicated loans. I mean, for example, and the instruments that were being traded were not publicly traded instruments. They were specially created instruments. Credit default swaps, asset-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations, collateralized mortgage obligations, swaps based on LIBOR. I mean, you can kind of get this idea of special contracts. For example, Tamarack was not financed by someone going to a bank and getting a loan with a bank. How were they financed? They were financed by a consortium put together by Credit Suisse, who went out and then resold that and a lot of little instruments out privately to a bunch of people. That was part of the shadow finance system. That was not a loan in a bank that the Fed would see. Now, one of the characteristics of this shadow finance system was that it depended on high leverage, because what they did was they were basically borrowing short from, you know, hedge funds, money market funds, through commercial paper or other sources, and then going out and buying instruments or actual investments that were going to pay off in 5 or 10 years. And they were oftentimes, now a normal bank is leveraged 5 to 10 to 1. Investment banks were leveraged at 30 or 40 to 1. What that means is if you lose 2% on your investment and you're leveraged at 40 to 1, you've lost 80% of your money. If your investment only goes down 3%, you're bankrupt. You have a very narrow, you know, you're so levered that small decreases in the value of the asset that you held has huge impacts on your solvency and your liquidity. You have to have people so you can continue to finance the short-term instrument, and you have to be able to make that spread. Now, what happened in the great collapse was that shadow financing network disappeared. It flat out disappeared. In the fall of 2008, before the September 11th, if you can remember, just taking you back to the wondrous days of yesteryear, left to right on your radio dial, subprime assets had become toxic. There was no trade. You remember the whole idea of subprime assets and mortgages. Those were a lot of the instruments that many people had invested in. But there's no trading on those. Bear Stearns had collapsed the year before. Many banks had already taken large write-downs. In the winter of that 2007, you may remember that Stan O'Neill out of Merrill Lynch Charlie Prince, Citicorp, had resigned because of the write-downs. But for the most part, people were still recovering from that. The Fed had rescued Bear Stearns, etc. Now, economic activity at that point was slowing, but it was still positive. Statistics had yet to see a real drop in GDP. And the consensus estimates at that time, as you saw earlier, was that there was going to be slow growth in 2009. Commodity prices were still somewhat robust. Federal Reserve was actually providing a fair amount of liquidity. They had said, we'll step in, and if you have good securities, we'll give you short-term cash so we can take care of your liquidity problems. And at that point, the market was down, but it wasn't out. Then we had the collapse. This, again, is one of those charts where at the bottom you have the calendar starting in March of 08, and then the months going from then. You see the Bear Stearns collapse. Then all of a sudden you see, starting on September 11th, you see that huge cliff-like rise to the greatest spread in history, where basically the financial system shut down. What happened during that month? That was the month that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were seized. Then Lehman was bankrupt. Then they had to rescue AIG. Then at that point, too, one of the big money market funds, Reserve Primary Fund, the oldest, broke a buck, basically freezing the assets there because Lehman went bankrupt. And then TARP failed, the first failure of TARP, and the markets just shut down. It only turned around, by the way, when the central banks came in to intervene and guarantee bank debt, guarantee commercial debt. That helped a little bit. And then another major thing happened about 2 weeks ago when the Federal Reserve said, basically, we're all in. We're going to do everything to stop this. Set the rates to zero. We'll start buying stuff. We'll expand our balance sheet. But that going up was clearly a huge event. Now, what was the cause of that? Well, what's been happening and what may happen in the future and the basic dynamic of what's going on now is that what's good for the individual is sometimes bad for the system. It is best seen in what was called the paradox of thrift by Keynes, where it's good for an individual to save. But if everybody saves, nobody's spending. And if nobody's spending, businesses can't make money and go under. If businesses go under, there's no jobs. And if there's no jobs, no one can save. Where there's a self-reinforcing effect, a snowball effect. And it happens in finance quite often. For example, it'll happen is if an individual lender decides, I'm going to wait a week before lending to someone, I have a few fears. So I'll wait a week, park it in treasuries. That may be fine for that, the right move for that individual bank. But if everybody waits that same week, it's a disaster. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It'll also happen where a business or a hedge fund or an investment organization has a portfolio that's going, all of a sudden, because of some stock market move, starts going up and down too much. What do? You raise a little bit of cash to dampen the portfolio. Well, the problem is if everybody tries to raise cash at the same time, The stocks become more volatile. The portfolio still is volatile. You've got to raise more cash to get yourself back to even. Everybody sells at the same time, and you're in this cascade effect. It happened. This was caused the 1987 market crash with portfolio insurance. This is also what caused long-term capital to go down when their risk control started that same sort of cascade effect. In this instance, Lehman was the snowball. I think that's pretty much the common wisdom right now. I think there's actually some other things that caused the snowball too, like not protecting the preferred in Fannie Mae. But for right here, Lehman was the snowball. Why? Well, first, people all of a sudden start saying, well, if Lehman can go, who's next? I'm going to sit on my cash for about another extra week to see. Who knows? Because at that point, the idea was that Lehman was a major player. Secondly, there was a lot of Lehman bonds in money market funds, short-term paper. And in fact, Reserve Prime Fund was the first, biggest, and oldest of the money market funds. They had $775 million of Lehman debt. When Lehman defaulted on that debt, the money market fund did what was called breaking a buck. And what breaking a buck means is that the value of all the assets they have are now less than $1, the dollar unit value, which in essence freezes all the participants in the fund. When First Reserve did that, all institutional investors got frightened and pulled money from all their money market funds. I mean, it happened to First Reserve, it could happen to mine. I'm going to pull it in to straight treasuries, pull it back. And they pulled back from the money market funds. The money market funds were one of the prime buyers of that short-term paper because they were cash money markets. They were trying to get short-term yields. And all of this system that depended on short-term financing couldn't roll their short-term debt, and they had huge liquidity problems. Banks in Europe, Iceland, this is how Iceland went under. And so, in fact, this was the main way that the problem was transferred from the U.S. overseas. There are other reasons as well why Lehman was the main snowball. I won't go into those right now, but the consequences of this great collapse were that the investment, the shadow finance system basically disappeared. There are no more Wall Street investment banks. They either converted to regular banks or went under. That whole model of the investment banking system is gone. There's no more special investment vehicles. There is no more shadow finance system. You can't put together an asset-backed security. You can't sell those types of securities, that whole finance system. That finance system, the best estimates were before this, were that over 50% of the world financing was going through that shadow finance system. Like I said, Tamarack wasn't going to a bank. They were using that system. When you were doing auto loans were being securitized and passed on to the market. GMAC was part of the shadow financing system. When they weren't doing auto loans, they can't sell GM cars. So all of a sudden, all the financing was shut off, and everybody who depended upon that didn't have financing, and the economy started shutting down. And by the way, that connection and that shutdown has surprised a lot of people again. I mean, the speed with which the economy nosedived in October was quite stunning. It only stopped when the governments stepped in, and even the visible finance system. People started to worry about regular banks in London, in Europe, and in the U.S., whether Citicorp was going to go under or other banks, so Wachovia, WaMu. You know, all of a sudden you started having real worries about banks going under and not being able to be rescued. This all stopped and turned around when the governments in October stepped in and guaranteed bank obligations, started throwing capital in, et cetera. And that's what turned it around. That's what made it all of a sudden start to ease off. And they poured in money into the system. Now, so as a result, in a way, what they've done now is they have pulled a lot of that shadow financing system into the visible system. They have brought money market funds in by guaranteeing money market funds. Investment banks have now been converted into real banks or bought by them. The Fed has said they're going to buy asset-backed securities. We are supporting AIG, who is the primary person behind the credit default swap market, agency securities. And there's pretty much only government-supported activity right now. There's private stuff is still frozen. The question is can you get enough money through this visible finance system out to the businesses and regular people before they go under? In other words, this visible system may not be big enough to throw the money all the way out there. Plus, the banks may not, you can give money to banks, they may not want to lend. I mean, remember, we got into this because they were lending to people who shouldn't have gotten money. And now they've pulled in their horns so much that they're worried about not only their own fate, but they're very happy just sitting with the reserves for the moment. So, where are we now? Well, the fear of financial Armageddon is fake. The financial markets have seemed to stabilize at a deep recession or normal crisis levels. And the markets are, in fact, showing some tangible signs of some recovery. I don't think anybody's worrying more about the visible financial system going under. But, as you heard from Mike yesterday, economic conditions are at recession levels. Bottom is not yet in sight. The government is the only lender and spender out there. Private activity is still near frozen. And really, unless you're in that visible circle, you ain't doing anything. Nobody's doing much of anything. And like I said, there's a race to restart the system before too much damage is done. Now, the next chart, basically, you saw it from Mike yesterday. I'm not going to go through it. You can see since the bottoms of October, things have improved, but only really improved back to crisis levels. As you can see, that TED spread, that's numbers going back to the 90s. You can see how big that spread was, but it's dropped back to basically a crisis level now. I'm going to go through these quickly because you've seen these yesterday. I'm sure other economists will show them to you. A-rated corporate debt reached all-time highs and is now back to where it was previously. Uncertainty in the stock market spiked tremendously. You've seen these sorts of things before. This is something called the Baltic Dry Index. Every crisis, every time you go through something new, there's a new fad index. For this crisis, the fad index is the Baltic Dry Index. It measures actual shipping contracts for merchant shipping. And it's a measure of the contracts outstanding. So people love this because it gives an indication of the nature of international trade. It went darn near down to zero. And now it's bottomed at very low levels. But commodities, as you know, have dropped and are just not coming back yet. Leading indicators show no sign of an approaching turnaround. Lead indicators have not yet turned up. Industrial production lead indicator hasn't turned up. The labor markets are still deteriorating, and the numbers today don't sound any better. Housing hasn't hit a clear bottom, still going down. And the other leading indicators don't show any sign yet of a turnaround. So, what are the current issues? There's three current issues. One, how much permanent damage was done by the Great Collapse? I mean, in other words, are securitized markets, for example, those asset-backed securities that were supporting auto loans, credit card loans, things of that nature, is that going to come back, or is the new visible system going to replace it? Because that has disappeared and frozen. That's the first major question. That's why you see the Fed saying now, we are going to buy asset-backed securities, because someone's got to buy it and then bring that system back, otherwise the financing won't be there. Can the money being poured into the visible system get to the regular business community? So this is what you hear about. You can give money to the banks, you can't make them lend. Or you can give money to the banks if nobody comes in to borrow it. It's as if you don't have any money at all. It's like giving us each $10 billion, if you go out and they actually print the bills, give it to us, if we go out in the backyard and start a bonfire, it's as if they never did it before, or if we bury them. It's got to be used before money's printed. And remember, there's a global recession out there. Can the Fed hold off the impacts of a global recession? Because many people think Europe is worse off than we are. So what will next year be like? Probably a good year, actually, for the capital markets. I'm looking for double-digit equity and corporate bond returns. Why? Well, we've dropped 50%. When you drop 50%, you've got to make 100% to get back to even. We're not going to make 100%. A 10 to 20% move up from here, however, is a reasonable balance once people see we've hit a bottom, and remember, the stock market anticipates this sort of stuff. I'm assuming, by the way, the Fed follows its statements that it's all in, that the U.S. will pass that $750 billion stimulus, that Europe continues the lower rates, and there's some stimulus passed there, like Germany announced yesterday of their $50 billion plan, and that the economy actually bottoms in the late second or third quarter. Now, because capital markets react in advance, when they see that bottom, they're going to start to anticipate a recovery, and that's what will be the bounce. And it could be 10, 20, 30%. You may get back halfway. So that's why next year the capital markets will likely be good. The market sectors themselves, well, large cap U.S. and small cap U.S. probably pretty good. Corporate credit is probably best positioned because the spreads on good quality corporate credit are very good. Governments, you've already got your run out of governments. It's unlikely you'll get more. Europe, probably not as good as us. They're in even worse economic shape, particularly the UK. Asia may be slightly better positioned. Private equity and private real estate, they still have to reflect the damage done, and they have lagging valuation, so they may not be as good next year. They're still going to be doing write-downs of 10 to 20% to 30%. Commodities likely to bottom, and hedge funds, you're going to have a very tough time. Long-term issues, this is my last slide. Long-term issues are the same as we've been talking about. Who's going to win? Who's going to replace that shadow finance system, or to what extent can it repair itself with this new regulation? Currently, we only have government-supported institutions. In the long term, that can't replace. What's going to come in to do that shadow finance system? Who's going to spend? When the going gets tough, the tough goes shopping. Consumers in the U.S. are stopping to shop. They're starting to save again. Their savings rate has been down to 0.6%. The problem is the U.S. consumer is 70% of our GDP. It's 25% of world GDP. And who can replace us if we decide not to go to the malls? 5 to 6% savings rate per year is about a $600 billion a year number. Somebody's got to spend that. And it doesn't look like Asia will, because it's tough to reverse the culture of savings, as Japan showed in their bad period of time. Europe's worse off than we are. UK's even worse. Africa's a generation away from being a consumer society. Who's going to replace it? And if we're entering an era of deleveraging, where people aren't going to keep as much debt on, well, less debt means less borrowing, means less purchasing power, means less growth. And then when you buy things with less debt, you have to put more equity in, which means you expect a higher return. The expected higher return means prices will be lower. Now, the final problem is deflation versus inflation. People are worried about inflation, but we won't get to that worry unless the current program to stop deflation gets traction. Remember, inflation fears are because the Fed is putting a lot of money out there in the form of reserves. But that money isn't printed until you get somebody lending and borrowing it. And our problem is nobody is lending and borrowing. So if we do get, it'll be nice to get to that problem. I mean, it'll be like leaping from the fire into the frying pan. It'll be relatively okay. We'll be relatively happy at the time. It'll be a relatively better place. But if we do get there, I'm actually more worried about that, because I'm pretty confident that all this money and buying and stimulus will get traction. The issue is central banks have always had a difficult time determining when they take the punch bowl away from the party. And there could be an inflation problem. But that's 2 or 3 years down. I will stop there. I have material on Percy if you want to go through that, but I'm willing to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you for that insightful presentation. Committee members, questions? Representative McGeehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Maynard. I really enjoy your presentation. Thank you. That's some good information and easy to understand. My question would be, why would we want to replace the shadow finance system if that's what largely caused the problem?
Mr. Maynard.
Mr. Chair.
There were some good things about it. For example, the idea of a mortgage-backed security now sounds like a dirty word. But the fact of the matter is there were good, it allowed a lot more money to come to bear and made it a lot easier for people who did deserve money to borrow. Because, for example, if you were an investor and you wanted to get a mortgage type, like maybe like all of us at our level want to be an investor, we want to get we can only usually get just regular corporate bonds. We want a mortgage type return because there's some good aspects to a mortgage type return. Without mortgage-backed securities, we'd have to go out to somebody else and say, I want to buy your mortgage, which means that a $200,000 add a chunk purchase, and you're taking the risk of that one mortgage. What a mortgage-backed security does, it takes 1,000 houses, and the mortgage is there, splits it up into 10,000 little units, and you can afford now one unit of a mortgage-backed security. It allows a broader distribution and a broader range of people to participate in the mortgage market. And that's the same way with the asset-backed securities of credit card receivables and loans. That whole system was set up to allow not only more people to put money into those securities, but also to allow, because there's more money, more people can therefore afford a house or a mortgage, or it's more plentiful. Now, the problem is that there was no way, it got to the point where nobody felt responsible for the loaning of the money. They would loan out, they would put in the security, all of it, and be so far passed out that it just got overdone. But there's some very good things. Because it's difficult to imagine, for example, if you're Cameron, I'm sorry to keep using that, but that's obviously has its faults as an example. But can you imagine going to the key bank and saying, give me a loan? A bank would not do that. A lot of projects were being financed by bringing in all the capital of the world through these securities into individual Credit Suisse was doing Tamarack. They were doing about 4 or 5 other big Western Resort projects. So it frees up a lot of capital. It makes more capital available for more activity. More activity means more growth. So there are aspects that were good. And that's the idea of regulation. The two things I think most people are concerned about, and if you do bring it back, one, transparency. Who's dealing with who? That was one thing nobody, it really was. The central banks were frightened. You could tell it all the way through statements a number of years ago. Light on that table, spider webs going into a dark room. And what happened is out here, part of this Lehman thing snapped, and the whole spider web collapsed. You couldn't see where all those activities were going. Secondly, all the contracts were complicated and individualized, and it didn't need to be. You need to get some regular a standardization of those contracts. If you know those two things, then you need the shadow financing system back, because otherwise there's real doubts as to whether normal old-fashioned banks can handle all of the lending requirements worldwide that we need to continue the growth that we have.
Representative Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Maynard. One of the major programs Idaho has been involved in the last 3 or 4 years is the Garvey program. The money that enables that program is acquired through the sale of bonds. And I know we have authorized appropriations that are not fully, the bonds have not been sold because of the market questions. I would appreciate your opinion on what we may be looking forward to on the future if we continue with that program. Thank you.
Mr. Maynard.
Are Garvey bonds tax exempt? They are. I am not an expert on tax exempt because obviously Percy does tax, so I don't watch that market. My guess is, though, that most because of the infrastructure support, there will be, once that's passed, there will be more security on the part of bond buyers when they come back into the market. I mean, you got two problems. One, there's fears of any state debt right now. You know, California out there saying, we're going bankrupt, everybody else kind of goes, well, that's, it's kind of like the Lehman thing. People kind of, well, we'll just sit on the sidelines for a few more months. You got that problem. But when they come back in the market, when and if, the idea of the infrastructure stimulus package passing Congress might give people more confidence in infrastructure-based bonds than otherwise. But Ron Crane is a much better person to answer that than me. I mean, I do not follow that part of the market.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Bob. Lehman Brothers was the was investment banker that was handling auto housing bonds, and so they collapsed, and those people that had investments in those bonds, to who do they look to for their payment? Do they look to auto housing, or the funds run still run through auto housing direct to the person that bought the portion of that bond from Lehman Brothers, or how's that all going to work?
Many years ago, when I was young and had potential, I was bond counsel for the state of Alaska, in-house bond counsel. I was a state attorney. At that time, unless the markets changed, once Lehman has sold the bonds, they're out of there. My assumption is there's a trustee that the disappearance of Lehman should not have affected the those bonds. They were simply the intermediary, because what happens is a trustee then is responsible for collecting the money and seeing that it's dispersed. So that's a more direct relationship. So I would be surprised if Lehman bankruptcy either one hurt the bonds, or if they were any way involved, that you couldn't get a substitute in there. That's my guess.
Thank you. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Mayor. Thank you. I just wondered, you had said that you see the economy bottoming in late second, third quarter. I wonder if you could venture your thoughts as to, do you think it's going to stay at the bottom throughout the year? Do you see a slight tick upward? And when might that happen, in your opinion?
Mr. Maynard.
I tend to be a more optimistic person than most. I think that the predictions of the everlasting doom of people borrowing and of the shadow financing system ever coming back and of asset-backed securities or mortgage-backed securities never coming back are incorrect. But I think when you try to pour this amount of money, people have short-term memories. You may remember that people were predicting the demise of mortgage-backed securities back in the early 90s when Orange County went bankrupt. There was that big fear of derivatives then. Came back stronger than ever a few years later. With this much liquidity and this much, and you got to remember too, we've only been in this 3 months. The real tragedy, it seems like it's been forever. When you're looking out 6 months from now, it fell quickly, and if the repair is done quickly, I don't think we'll bounce back to where we were. I think there's been too much damage for that. But I think there could be a substantial bounce back, simply because, and it really depends on how much permanent damage was done by October. So I think it's a slight U-shape. It'll go down, hit bottom for a while, and then I'm actually really more worried about inflation later on, because in a sense, it's like instead of pumping water to put out a burning house, they're pumping gasoline to start a small fire somewhere. And it's very tough to light a match to one part of a gasoline pool and not have the whole thing go up. I'm actually more worried about that 2 years down the line. I think we're going to feel good for about 6 months, and then all of a sudden people are going to say, inflation. But I could be wrong. I was put on the spot by my chair when they were looking at the special meeting in December. At that point, Percy for the fiscal year was down about 25%. We're now down about 19 for the fiscal year. That's actually relatively good performance. I'm relatively very happy with what we've done. Again, that's different. But they were having to deal with the COLA issue, and that's just why I'm glad we have a public board rather than leaving it to us bureaucrats, because I've never seen people agonize so much over something in my life. But one of the things that Jody Olson, the chair, asked me was, he asked me for a prediction as to where the fund was going to be at June 30 of this year. Now, I'm going to be wrong on this, there's no question, but I'll offer the same bet to any of you. My guess is that we're going to be at that point we were down 26. My guess was that we were going to be down negative 10 to negative 15 as of June 30, that we'd have bounced back approximately halfway. And so the over-under is negative 10 to negative 15. I'll bet a designer cup of coffee if it's under negative 10, you have to buy me a designer cup of coffee. If it's over negative 15, I'll buy you. And negative 10 to negative 15 for Percy is a push. So that's my best guess right now. Luckily, no decisions made on Percy have to depend on my ideas of where the market goes.
Senator LeFevre.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions, but I guess I'll just go with this first one, and that is around the question of that. I guess I'm going to call it fictional value, but the leveraging of anywhere from 40 to 50% that took place, and that loss in value that we know is out there, and you're talking about being absorbed by the real solid financial system as opposed to the shadow one. That loss in value, do you have any understanding of where that has taken place? I mean, you talked about China and other Asian countries and having invested fairly heavily. I imagine they lost a great deal of value out of that they may never recover. I mean, some of it we're obviously seeing trickling down to wage earners and job losses and things like that, which is really real wages that we're losing. But do you have any other sense of the distributive analysis of where that really vanished and probably will stay permanently gone?
Yes.
Mr. Maynard.
Oh, Mr. Chair, sorry. Yes. There's two parts, one of which is the loss in value of a lot of the bonds. You divide it into fixed income and equity values. On fixed income, there is the potential losses are approximately, for the mortgage-backed securities, are about $1 trillion. And the potential losses people see on the other types of loans and bonds and asset-backed securities that are out there still to be really written down is another trillion, about 50-50. 2 trillion plus or minus half a trillion is the number. Banks have already written down about half the losses of what people think are out there on the bond side. And the reason those bonds are less valuable, like for the subprime bond, because the housing prices have gone down. And so the basic cause there is the drop of housing. And then the other drop of other corporate bonds and asset-backed securities are the fears of default by people who own auto loans, consumer loans, things of that nature. So that's about $2 trillion. With regard to and to put this in context, by the way, the U.S. GDP per year is $15 trillion. And we're about a third, 25% to a third of the world economy. Okay. Equity losses have been approximately $6 trillion up till now. And that is solely because people are no longer expecting the profits from the companies that they did previously. So those are the two. So generally the numbers I've seen have set up to now is about $8 trillion of losses out there. In terms of what's a real loss versus an expected loss, the real loss in terms of just common sense feeling are more the bond losses, because you actually do have houses underlying half of that problem that are now 20 to 30% of housing loss. And many people think if you cure the housing portion, the rest cures itself. I think it's too far for that, but that's a different issue.
Okay, we have two more questions on Senator Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Maynard. Excellent presentation. Yesterday, a common theme among the presenters seemed to be that as we looked at the different graphs, they show that the economy would recover in late 2010 or early 2011. How would you feel about that? What's your take on that?
My take on this, just sure. I apologize. When I first started off in Alaska, I did a lot of, and that was not my natural tendency. I apologize to the chair.
Not at all.
Continually for that sort of thing. My take is as follows. It may be true, but here's my fear. I think we're in one of these situations. Sometimes you have a guess, and you could be equally right, equally wrong. And it's kind of a smoother distribution. But the problem I think we see right now is when the Fed goes all in, they're either going to be right or they're going to be wrong. And if they're wrong, all heck breaks loose. I think the problem here is that 85% chance it works, in which case it'll work sometime by the second or third quarter. 15% chance that we better go out, start an apple orchard and find our place on a street corner and start selling them, because if all heck's going to break loose. If this doesn't work, if the Fed does pull out all the stops and we still have deflation and everybody stays in their foxhole, that snowball continues on. And you know, it's not one of those smooth things, well, if you're wrong, it'll come a quarter earlier or two or three quarters later. It's if they're wrong, my fear is all heck breaks loose. So I generally think second or third quarter. I actually think it may be sooner, only because people were so surprised how quickly the financial meltdown in September, October transmitted itself to the real economy. In the back of my mind there's an idea, if we were surprised on the downside that quickly, we may be surprised on the upside if we get traction.
Senator Baer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Maynard, you've mentioned that you think that the stabilization that we've seen so far in the stock market and the financial markets have come as a result of the government support and the investments that they've made into those markets. Where is the money coming from? I mean, the Fed just, are they manufacturing it out of midair?
Mr. Maynard.
Mr. Chair. Senator. There's two types of government support going. One type is where the government is using existing money and getting something in return. For example, when the Treasury puts money into the banks, that's money on hand that's been printed, and they are actually getting preferred shares. In the same way, the initial idea of the TARP program was you get $700 billion and we're going to buy all these securities. Well, is that going to cost us $700 billion? No. Those securities were worth something. The question is what? But say they held them for 4 years, sold them back in the market, they could have made a profit. And in fact, the government has made profits on when they bailed out Chrysler. They got Chrysler stuff. They made money on that. They made money on the Mexican bailout. So, and that's one situation where the government's getting something in return. And the question is, when they sell it back, will they get the same amount? There, the amount. And so when the Federal Reserve, for example, says we're going to go out and buy asset-backed securities, they basically print money on one hand, but get something in exchange. So they simply say, you have the liability of the Federal Reserve, which is pretty good, and I get your commercial mortgage-backed security, we're going to put it in our little vault, electronically speaking. That sort of stuff doesn't really affect the monetary base. That's not really new money in a sense, except for the fact, because you're trading a long-term good for a short-term. The issue is when they try to send that back out, are they making a profit or not? Now, there's another way they create reserves. And that is when they basically do print money and they hand these reserves out to the banks or wherever it may be. Again, that money isn't printed until it's lent and spent. So basically, the way the Federal Reserve makes new money is that they just don't roll a printing press. What they do is they go to a bank and they credit a account with that bank with more reserves. And then the bank itself then can go out with those greater reserves and lend it, say, to you. When they do that, you then have money you can spend. But if you don't go in and borrow that money, and nobody goes in and borrows that money, or the bank doesn't do anything with it and just sits there and says, we have more reserves, the money isn't printed yet, isn't in circulation. Money is a medium of exchange, and it's got to be exchanged before it exists. So in other words, the Fed can do this infinitely. It has an infinite balance sheet. They can just, I mean, that's why they call them Helicopter Ben, because he referred to a previous statement by, was it Friedman? There's a helicopter statement. Anyway, he referred to a statement that says, if they can go out at worst, just take a helicopter and drop money. They can actually print it and drop it on the streets. They can do it at an infinite amount. It's not tied to any rule or whatever. Did that help? I apologize. It's oftentimes money is a state of mind. Listen, I will be glad on the cheap day. I will buy the coffee, and I'll sit down and diagram it out at some point. There's no limit to the amount of money they can print. It can't be created out of thin air, but it really is only printed if it's used.
We're just a little behind. Senator LaFaber, if you have a quick question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if this is quick, so maybe you can answer it afterwards, but I thought it was relevant to budget writing and it might be a good question, and that is, in terms of inflation, are a lot of those fears based on concerns about energy costs and food production and real shortages in those senses? And would something like, you know, greater investment in alternatives and greater energy independence perhaps alleviate that somewhat for us? And in that sense, I guess I'll just leave it there. Thank you.
Mr. Maynard.
Chair. Senator. I think the problem is actually the opposite of that. The problem now is there's overcapacity in almost anything you look at. From factories for autos to memory chips to production of oil, there's more. The real problem that's faced out there is there's more capacity out there to make things than there is people willing to borrow and buy. So making more capacity is just not a supply problem right now. It's a demand problem. And so that would, in my mind, not help, because the number somebody say yesterday in these hearings that there's 100 more auto factories worldwide than the need for autos. So building another auto factory is not going to help that. And I think you can generalize that to the world economy right now.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Mr. Maynard, for the presentation and allowing for so many questions. Thank you.
Anytime. And again, I will offer, because I'm a cheap date, I will buy the coffee if anybody wants to talk about this stuff. I love this stuff, so I'll figure out a better way to get the get a quick answer.
Thank you again. Committee, our next presentation will be by Mr. Mike Lennison of Micron Technology. I'm quite confident he's prepared to ask exceedingly pointed questions. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Reynoldson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Chairman Baer, Chairman Getty, members of the committee. My name is Mike Reynoldson. I'm an employee of Micron Technology here in Boise. Well, it seems like we're just here. Boy, it's, you know, I walk in here and it's like I was giving this speech last year. And I think I was more optimistic last year. I'm not sure. Anyway, as I read in the paper today, Micron isn't the only company that's gone through some tough times over the year. It seems like other industries and other companies have. To get started, I'm actually going to play you an audio clip, Mr. Chairman, if that's okay. Okay, thank you. From an interview with our CEO following our December 11th shareholders meeting, if I can make the technology work here.
We are hopeful that the first quarter of this coming year is the worst that we will experience.
A new year is on the horizon, yet good news is not. In its annual shareholders meeting today, Micron leaders admitted times are very tough, industry-wide and nationwide. But when comparing Micron's financial situation with that of other semiconductor companies, CEO Steve Appleton says the Treasure Valley's largest employer is poised for survival.
We are the only remaining DRAM producer in America. That's it. There used to be probably 40 or 50 companies worldwide that produce DRAM or develop DRAM technology, and now there's five of us, and there, you know, may only be three or four of us here in the near future. So we have our challenges, and I would never propose that we've done everything right. But on a relative basis, we think we keep making course corrections to at least survive. You know, my comment would be, we haven't filed bankruptcy. We don't have any government bailouts coming our way. Our cash balance is okay, and we're moving forward. That's, in my mind, really the measurement that we're looking at.
Over the past year, Micron announced a 15% reduction in its workforce and cut its manufacturing costs by 60%. But during that same time frame, its product prices dropped even further, DRAM down 80%. And consumer spending is of paramount concern.
I don't think Micron can recover alone, independent of the economy. We have to get some breathing room. We don't need big recoveries in the economy, but we need some stabilization.
Despite the economic uncertainty, Appleton says he does not foresee more layoffs in the company's near future.
You know, there's never any guarantees because we don't know if it's just a recession, a severe recession, or a depression. But we think that we're in as good a shape as anybody in our industry to move forward.
Allison Uten, Idaho News Channel 7.
And given market conditions, Appleton says Micron won't be building any new fab facilities in the near future, but it will continue looking for opportunities to partner with other companies.
Okay. Whoops. Or just can somebody. So that's that was kind of the outlook from our annual shareholders meeting. And now I'll I wanted to go through a couple of headlines that kind of tell the story of what's been going on in our industry over the last couple of months. And there's a couple of things I want you to kind of focus on. On the negative side, what we're going through in the industry, and it's really worldwide when it comes to semiconductor manufacturing, that's our business, historically low prices for the products we produce. low demand for the products we produce or a decreased demand. And all companies are suffering, including our competitors. And what you're going to see is you're going to see several headlines dealing with foreign stimulus packages. Not necessarily focusing on U.S. stimulus, but foreign stimulus is more of what's on our mind in terms of concerns. On the positive side, it appears that in addition to Micron, most of our competitors have reduced their output as well. When output goes down, generally prices tick up a little bit, and that's a good thing. And then consolidation. You're going to see, I think, more news, and you'll see this through the clips on consolidation. And as you look at these headlines, we'll start, I'm not going to go through all of them, but you see Taiwan DRAM makers to report gigantic losses for the third quarter. China plans to bolster its slowing economy. You're going to see several on China. China needs radical stimulus package. DRAM is one of the main products that we make, cutting inventories amid weak demand. Elpida is one of our main competitors. They're delaying the building of one of their manufacturing facilities in China. You see that November DRAM prices basically fall again. Qimonda is one of our competitors that we actually acquired a portion of their business over the last year, and we acquired that business at rock bottom prices. It has been long rumored that they are on their last legs, but recently they did get an infusion of cash from the German government, so they are going to stay around for a little while. Stimulus in China, again, Taiwan DRAM makers have a net profit margin of -72%. Output just shrank in the first quarter of 2009. That's the quarter that we just finished, and we did reduce our output some. If you look at where we're doing business, and I think I always remind you of this, China consumed one-third of chips in 2007. It used to be that two-thirds of what we produce and sell goes to Asia. And 10 years ago, it was the reverse. I think two-thirds or 60% actually went to the United States. Prices down again in November. DRAM and NAND, again, pricing for our products dropped to new lows. Number of DRAM makers in Asia to shrink. Again, that's a positive for us. Consolidation, we believe, is needed in the business. November sales expect to plunge. Fall seen for DRAM in the third quarter, falling again in December. We have actual companies speaking out about the need for government aid. ProMOS is one of our competitors, PowerChip, one of our competitors. China says maintaining a stable, fast economic growth is a top priority in 2009. You could probably pretty much put any country in there. One of our competitors cut staff. Taiwan government confirms it has a DRAM rescue plan, but not willing to provide details. Semiconductor revenues declined $12 billion in 2008. Now, on a good note, we have an analyst seeing a demand increase in 2010. And I think we are generally predicting that same thing. Germany not ruling out Qimonda aid. They have given that aid. Hynix, another one of our big competitors, cutting output in late December. Taiwan DRAM makers to get $6.5 billion in basically rescue package. Hynix is another one of our competitors that has really been suffering, and recently the South Korean banks gave them some relief in their credit obligations, which I think was helpful to them. Again, delaying plant construction. So that's kind of the story of our industry, and that's really over the last 2 months, it seems as though we see more information on what's going on. You know, in the down times, there come opportunities. And if natural market forces are allowed to work, if you can survive those down times and you're one of those still standing, you're in a really strong position. We feel like we're well positioned compared to our competitors. In fact, one of the top two or three in the entire industry. However, when you have some artificial forces come in, such as those rescue packages from foreign governments, that's where we see some concern, because then you have those elements coming in that that are of benefit to your competitors that you don't necessarily that allow them to stay around a little longer and cause you concern. So some of our key impacts in 2008. In April, we announced a joint venture with Nanya, which is a fabrication production facility in Taiwan. That's a Taiwanese chip maker. And what you've seen us do is you've seen us do a lot of partnerships. When you form a partnership with another producer, you spread the risk. And often, we're known as being a technology leader. So we can often bring technology and manufacturing expertise to the table, where our competitors can often bring capital to the table. So it's a way of getting some low-cost capital and spreading your risk in order to more effectively compete. So you've seen us form partnerships, and you'll continue, I think, to see us form more partnerships. Another one of our partnerships was with Intel, and that was on a manufacturing facility we were going to ramp up in Singapore. We had to delay the ramping of that facility, probably similar to what you saw us do in Utah a few years ago. We announced that in August. In October, we reported our financial results for the fiscal year of 2008, which was a $1.6 billion loss for the year. Now, not all of that was cash. Some of it was due to some accounting that we're required to report, and the accountants in the room are probably more familiar than I am. When your stock price is significantly lower than your book value of your assets, you are required to adjust your inventory, the cost of your inventory, and some of these things, and it's kind of a financial write-down, but it shows as a loss on your books. So that was part of that. In October, we also announced that we would have a slowdown in December, basically reduce our, we announced that we would shut down one of our fabrication facilities in Boise and reduce our workforce. And I think you're all familiar with that. It was about a 15% reduction in our workforce. Most of that has occurred at this time. But when you see the data that you're seeing on unemployment and those kind of things, I think that our employment reduction was a big part of that. Obviously, this is the second year in a row that we've had to do that kind of thing. The fabrication facility that we shut down was an older facility, older technology in terms of the manufacturing. It was, again, part of that partnership that we have in Intel in terms of the product that it was putting out. And it just, prices were so low, we just couldn't keep it going anymore. We were not recovering our costs on that production. In October, this goes back to opportunities presenting themselves. We acquired two Taiwanese manufacturing facilities, a portion of those facilities, from a German company, from Qimonda. And basically, an analyst described it this way. We got $3 billion in value. If you had to build these facilities from scratch, $3 billion in value for the cost of $400 million. So when you can get those kind of fire sale prices on manufacturing, you need to jump on them. December, We announced our first quarter financial results, a $706 million loss. Again, part of that was some accounting that we are required to do, but nonetheless, obviously not positive. We also announced a mandatory production slowdown where basically everyone took 2 weeks off. It was required as part of the company. We reduced our output, and we needed to get some vacation time off the books. So Monday, I just came back to the real world myself, and but we all had a two-week period of time off as part of this production slowdown. This month, we also have salary reductions kicking into place, not only for our upper management, but any employee making over $60,000 a year will see a salary reduction on a sliding scale. Yes, I'm in that category. And we have a bonus program that we have suspended at this time. But, you know, we're all still working. It, people understand that those are the steps that have to be taken. But you are obviously going to see probably impacts of that when it comes to sales and income tax. So with that, I do want to reiterate that we are, compared to others in our industry, we feel like we're in a strong position. With the changes that we've made, we feel like we're going to see a cash savings over the next 2 years of about $400 million. In other words, over the last 2 years, we've reduced our costs so significantly that we are, I think, to the bare minimum in our minds in terms of our operations, and we've saved a lot of costs that we previously had. We have reduced our capital expenditures budget over the next year by about 40%, from about $1 billion to $1.3 billion down to about $650 to $750 million. We do have $1 billion cash on hand, which relative, again, to our competitors is a very strong position to be in. And if you look at our debt to capital ratio, we're about 35% debt to capital, and the industry average is about 46% debt to capital. So we're in a stronger position there as well. So with that, it's going to be bare bones for us over the next year, and that's I assume that you were probably calculating that anyway, but in terms of any sort of major growth or major expansion, we are in a you know, kind of a get back to basics mode. We have seen pricing on our products tick up just a tad recently. Now, when you start, I want to preface that, though, that when you start at a very low point, ticking up, it's just ticking up a tad, and I think that's based on some reduced output and some production that Micron and others have reduced. But we have seen prices tick up, and so there's some optimism on that. You've actually seen our stock price go from about $2.50 to $3.50 over the last 2 weeks or so, which percentage-wise is a great growth, but still has a long way to go. And I think that's primarily based on pricing. Anyway, that's my presentation for today, and be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Senator Fletcher.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Mike, thanks for the presentation and doing what you do. I think most of us realize that as an industry leader, a technology leader, the migration to new technology is a particular driver, and Micron's dependent on being an early adopter of new technology. In your view, with this slowdown that we're all seeing economically, do you anticipate this economic slowdown to act as more of an accelerator towards the adoption of new technology so that the leaders can lower costs quicker? Or would you see this economic slowdown as a decelerator for that migration to new technology because there's simply not the demand and the desire to expend capital?
Mr. Wendelson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Folster, in terms of a lot of the old technology, 200 millimeter manufacturing, which I know you're familiar with, others may not be as familiar, but that's the size of the wafer, I brought those in before, that we manufacture on. We have seen basically that type of manufacturing is the type of manufacturing that people are shutting down. That's what we shut down here in Boise. Hynix, one of our competitors, had a similar manufacturing facility in, I think, Eugene, Oregon. They shut that down. And we've seen some others shut down. However, capital expenditure budgets and research and development budgets are being reduced. And with that reduction, I think it is possible that the advancements won't occur quite as quickly, but there is a big move and a big push for manufacturers to all move to 300 millimeter technology, which is what we have in most of our manufacturing, and the partnerships that we're going into, again, are on 300 millimeter manufacturing. We're seen as a technology leader, which I think gives us more of an opportunity to form partnerships with other companies. Through those partnerships, it'll pick up again. That's what will move it more quickly, because we'll be stronger as with those partnerships. So I think it'll be slower probably through 2009 and then pick up from there.
Representative McKeon.
Thank you. And Mike, yesterday we received some information from the Department of Labor about wage jobs and wage impact losses in that different segment. And by far the highest impact to the loss of jobs and wages in Idaho are in the computer and electronics manufacturing. And so really the key to digging out of this is all in jobs and creating jobs. And it seems to me the biggest bang for the buck that we could get in Idaho would be to focus on those segments where the highest number of jobs and the highest impact of wages to the economy. And looking at the average wage in that segment is $79,000 a year, which is also by far the highest category. My question to you would be, if there was one thing that the state of Idaho could do to assist the computer and electronics manufacturing industry, what would that be?
Mr. Reynoldson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McGann, I'm going to give you more than one. you're exactly right. That's correct. You know, it's interesting. Typically, our wages have been about 87% above the state average, which I think the number that you quoted is probably even a little higher than that. And you're seeing it from electronics and high-tech manufacturing. We own a building over in Nampa where our tenant has just announced that they're no longer going to be doing business in NBC Computer, which actually has its roots with Micron, but we are the owner of that building. So if you look at some of the ideas, I'm going to be very straight with you. Personal property is important to us. You know, whether we make $1.6 billion or we lose $1.6 billion a year, we're still paying on that personal property. And obviously, our personal property bill or our personal property value is going to decrease this year because we're removing equipment from that fabrication facility. But that is a that is a big issue for us, and we would like to see that eliminated. Number two, if you looked at last year, you passed some legislation dealing with Areva and Eastern Idaho, and that was good legislation, and we'd love to see that maybe revised in a way or positioned in a way where other companies, large property value companies could take advantage of that as well. And then third, if you look at that building that we have in Nampa and our soon-to-be empty fabrication facility here, we're always looking for opportunities to put those assets back to work. And you know, one of the areas that we've looked is in production of energy manufacturing of renewable energy type products. And so there may be, there are some other states that have done some things to try and create incentives along along those lines that we would be interested in seeing. Oregon comes to mind in particular in terms of the new types of manufacturing that we may be interested in putting in place. And it's just preliminary discussions that we're looking at, but we're always looking at ways to put those assets back to work.
Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of the changes you've described, both positive and negative, sound to me they're mainly due to with chip size and things of that nature, which are essentially cost factors. Is Micron, I'm not asking for any trade secrets here, but is there anything on the horizon in terms of new memory technology other than simply cost-cutting measures?
Mr. Reynoldson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Killen, we're always working on our research and development and improving our technology, both improving the technology and how we manufacture and what we manufacture. So, yes, we're constantly doing that. And in fact, the remaining fabrication that we have in Boise is the 200 millimeter manufacturing. It's the older type of manufacturing. But we are efficient enough at that, and I think technology leaders at that, that we're still able to make good margins on those products. They're different than the line we shut down. We're making different products there. So we're still capitalizing on that, those technology advances that we've made. But the cost cutting and the leveraging with partners is really where we can see the efficiency and the savings at this time.
Thank you, committee. Thank you very much for that presentation, Mike. Appreciate it. Committee, we're running just a little behind. We're going to move right on to our next presenter, Mr. Alex LeBeau from the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry. Welcome to the committee, Mr. LeBeau. I'll give you just a moment to get set up, and the floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, while he's getting set up, if I could...
Senator Gibbs, please.
Thank you.
Kitty, excuse me.
Senator Bellew had an article this morning that talked about $9 million in unemployment benefits being paid this last week. So I asked Mr. Houston to get Bob Fick a number for us. That represented 40,252 checks. So we had 40,252 Idaho citizens collecting unemployment. That's what the $9 million was.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alex LeBeau, and I am the president of the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry. It's been a couple of years since I've been in front of the Economic Outlook Committee in my former position with the Idaho Association of Realtors. We used to be able to present very rosy pictures, but after listening to John Eaton yesterday, I'm kind of glad I didn't have to make that presentation. But I got to tell you, my presentation that I'm here to make today isn't that much better. But I do hope that some of the information that we provide today here is useful. What I handed out to you was some information that we received in February of 2008. It has not been updated since that time. Simple Manufacts that was put together by our national affiliate, the National Association of Manufacturers, that kind of gives you a picture of what we look like in the state of Idaho with respect to manufacturing. Probably no surprise that 93% of all that we export in the state of Idaho comes from manufacturing facilities. The information that I have up on the wall here, this comes from the Institute for Supply Management. Our National Association of Manufacturers uses to determine this information for much of the economic outlook that I'm about to present. The median line that you can see in every one of those graphs is 50. If you are above 50, you're in a growth pattern. If you're below 50, you're in a contraction pattern. And you can see that we have had a very, very steep decline particularly in the last quarter of 2008 for all manufacturing nationwide. These are all critical, obviously, to the health of overall manufacturing in the United States as well as in the state of Idaho. This is the overall picture, December over December, which you can see in the last quarter of 2008, there was a dramatic drop-off. This is the Institute for Supply Management. And you can see that we were bumping along there nationally pretty well. We dropped below 50. Again, that's the standard of whether you're growing or contracting. And you can see between August and December of 2008, it was as if everything just stopped. Although, what this also indicates, in December, for example, nationwide, we lost alone 120,000 jobs. 120,000 jobs in manufacturing alone in 1 month. We did receive a report this morning, however, that the numbers have come in for December for the latest jobless claims. New jobless claims actually did not increase over this last period. That's a little bit of good news. I wouldn't jump on it, but it is some good news that I will try to put into this presentation. This is what we're predicting. I think this is what you're looking for. This is the number that we're putting out, and the national prediction, which is largely what you're looking for. We were down 2.4% in 2008, thinking nationally to be down in 2009 by 1.6%. That's the overall economic outlook from the National Association of Manufacturers. Manufacturing production, obviously, is more severe. It declined 6.4% in 2008 and will likely decline by another 2% in 2009. This recession, as I think you've heard before, even with our economists, will likely rival the early 80s and perhaps be the deepest in the post-World War II era. This is where we've been in the state of Idaho over the last 10 years. The growth of manufacturing in the state of Idaho versus the United States, while this is a positive way of looking at it, a couple of things that I want to point out with respect to the state of Idaho when it comes to manufacturing. Between January 1 and August 2003, we actually lost total manufacturing jobs by about 14% in the state of Idaho. We gained those back between August 2003 and May of 2007. We brought back 10% of manufacturing jobs. But since May of 2007, we've seen a 12% drop in total manufacturing employment in the state of Idaho. This has outpaced the national average of that same period, which has seen a reduction of only 5% of total manufacturing. Why? We're not that diverse. Over 54% of our manufacturing base is in electronic computers and food products. And you can see how we compare nationally, where the largest production of manufacturing is in chemical and pharmaceuticals, but Idaho drops off pretty dramatically outside of the other two. Wood products, obviously, is another large sector of our manufacturing economy. We started seeing that within the IACI organization in early to mid-2007, where a lot of our manufacturers that produce finished wood products for construction started seeing dramatic drop-offs, and that was an early signal for us that we were going to be having some problems. Lacking that diversity makes us more susceptible to larger swings in manufacturing performance and job claims based on specific industries. So how do we look overall? Mr. Chairman and Mayor Smith, I've got to apologize to you. I don't have a specific Idaho statistic, so and we have yet to develop one within IACI specifically on manufacturing. We've been working with our National Association of Manufacturers. So the best I could do was to call some of my manufacturing facilities throughout the state and kind of give you an anecdotal picture of what they're saying out there. Now, some of the information that they gave me was proprietary, in an effort to conglomerate it to give you an overall picture of what we can expect in the various regions of the state. Eastern Idaho. Eastern Idaho is actually doing reasonably well in a down economy when it comes to manufacturing, and this is due to the fact that the number of food processing facilities and fertilizer producers over there have actually done very well in 2008. Some have experienced their best year ever in 2008. They don't anticipate they will experience their best year ever in 2009, but they don't anticipate that they're going to have a drop-off. And they're not looking at significant job creation, but they're not looking at significant job losses, which is probably the key element. A lot of their production is based off the fact they've spent a lot of time working on their ability to produce in a very effective manner, even in a down economy, to go through that. Food is a basic commodity, and manufactured food, people still buy it in a down economy. So that's the good news for the state of Idaho and eastern, particularly in the eastern side of the state. There will be some hiring in VM and Bonneville County, Premier Technology. One of the bright spots in eastern Idaho, one of our members, is looking to do more hiring in 2009. They're still short welders. They want welders. With the addition of the Areva plant, that's an also a very positive sign for eastern Idaho, certainly as we move forward. Those involved in solar in Pocatello should experience an increase in demand as requests for their energy products increase. And again, many have reported a more stable commodity market, which is key to the raw products area, which could signal that we may still be down through much of 2009, but we do anticipate a late recovery. Same is true throughout much of southern Idaho regarding food processing, milk, sugar, and potatoes. I think you heard from the milk industry that generally things are down with respect to their commodity. However, sugar prices and the sugar economy is actually doing pretty well. And they're looking at a fairly positive situation with the new Obama administration that is much more friendly to their industry than the previous administration when it comes to sugar prices and sugar imports. Nevertheless, they are diversifying their product dramatically. And sugar has been one of the few bright spots in the economy. Again, they're not looking at significant hiring, but they're not looking at layoffs either when it comes to refined sugar. But in western Idaho, as you just heard, if there was ever a term company town, Idaho's more like a company state. So goes Micron, so goes the economy of the state. They're an enormous producer, an enormous exporter in this state. And other large employers such as HP in this economy in western Idaho will hopefully mitigate some of the losses. But nevertheless, we've heard even as late as today that PC demand has gone down. Printer demand as a result probably will go down. But HP has positioned themselves very well to weather the down economy, just as Micron has. But without an increase in consumer demand of electronic equipment, those industries are going to continue to flag in this down economy. Globally, as you've heard, globally competitive policies are critically important to these industries. You heard from Micron regarding all of their competitors out there and those countries where they are located receiving a tremendous amount of help from their governments. And I don't think that Micron is necessarily looking for a bailout package similar to what's going on in Detroit, but a lot of these industries could use some help with respect to their policies. Northern Idaho. Northern Idaho is a very interesting mix, and the result is we have a mixed bag of reports. You heard yesterday about finished wood products. I think I reiterated that you've seen a dramatic drop in construction and housing, nothing new there. But in speaking with several of our members that are in the North Idaho Manufacturing Consortium, the total number of jobs that they anticipate bringing on in 2009, they're actually talking about increasing that number by a factor of about 300. Will that mitigate all of the job losses from the construction industry? Doubtful. But it does hopefully stabilize at least the northern portion of the state. And again, I worked hard to find some good news to bring to the committee, but there are a few bright spots out there. This is largely due to the diversity of the various manufacturing facilities that are up there, and North Idaho has done a tremendous job in not only recruiting a wide variety of manufacturing, but it's a lot of mid-sized manufacturers that provide full benefits, great jobs, $14 an hour on average, looking at $45,000 a year, and if we can continue to foster that environment, the rest of the state could learn a lot from what's going on up there. November of 08, these are, I'm not going to stand by these numbers, partly because of the dramatic drop-off that we saw in December, so I think it's actually worse. The U.S. is down from manufacturing production by 7.3%, negative 4.7% in Idaho again. Total drop for the economy, we're looking at a contraction of 1.6% with manufacturing being down a total of 2%. We anticipate, however, that a late recovery will occur in Idaho if commodities continue to stabilize. Late recovery as in fourth quarter calendar year 2009. This is some information that I wanted to provide the legislature about what the impacts are of 100 manufacturing jobs and what that brings to your economy, and why it's important for the legislature to focus on policies that help the manufacturing sector to diversify and expand in your economy. Pretty dramatic numbers. You're talking about value-added positions that create even more jobs, more personal income, more bank deposits, more retail, more purchases, more increase in tax revenue. All of this information is very positive information. When we can find those jobs, when we can find those production facilities and help them grow, this is the impact that the state of Idaho could get to. So how do we do it? How do we grow manufacturing in the state of Idaho? We not only want to come to you with our problems, we want to come to you with our proposed solutions. Common thread in our mind for this year, for this legislature, is infrastructure. Education is the top of the list. The Idaho Education Network that passed this legislature unanimously needs some funding. We are in a down economy. There are very few funds out there to put to it. But the Idaho Education Network, IAACI, will be strongly supporting funding from the legislature to get that project underway. And the reason that this is critically important is kids in Meridian or Boise or big districts, big school districts, have every opportunity in the world because they're located close to a four-year university. They have a diverse opportunities that are out there. Kids in Kuski don't get those same opportunities. How do we connect the entire state to this education opportunity that's out there? Well, first of all, we need to stop thinking of K-12, and we need to start thinking of K-20. It's an education system in the state that we need to connect all of our universities, all of our high schools together so that those very talented teachers in Idaho Falls can connect with those kids in Eden that wouldn't necessarily get the opportunity to have an advanced placement class in physics, for example. Even the industries out at INL, you've got some very talented professors out there and people that do research that it'd be phenomenal if we could get kids excited about the science and technology of manufacturing that goes on out there and really see where it can go. The Idaho Education Network is a very inexpensive way for this state to move that ball forward. Energy. We are a net importer of energy. We are beholden to other states when it comes to our energy needs. We don't have any large-scale production outside of hydro. We don't have coal in this state, largely because of policies of the state of Idaho. We cannot build a coal plant in the state of Idaho. But nevertheless, we get a fairly large portion of our energy from coal in the state of Idaho. We need more energy. So if we can't build generation, what do we need to do? We need to get more transmission. We have an aging transmission system that is at capacity. We need to change some policies to reduce the overall cost of entry into the market when it comes to investment in transmission across the state of Idaho. And I think you're going to be seeing some policies that are being negotiated even within my board of directors, as well as with the governor's office moving forward when it comes to energy incentives for alternative and renewables. You've got to add those to the portfolio, but you've also got to be able to get that where it's needed into the industries, into manufacturing, and into the homes. You can't grow without it. Tax policy. You heard about personal property tax. It is still the single largest issue that my members in the manufacturing industry complain about. It is the easiest way for this legislature to find a way to help overall manufacturing and make this state more attractive. Long gone were the days where you could just sit back and say, well, they're going to locate in the state of Idaho, expand in the state of Idaho because it's a great place to live. There's a lot of great places to live in this world. And you can see that by the tremendous amount of recruitment that goes on all over this country. We need policies to make sure that Idaho doesn't get overlooked for expansion. The best way we can grow is from within. And if we can put those resources back in employers' pockets so that they can hire more people and spend that money on equipment, the better off the state's going to be. The second one, corporate income tax. We have one of the highest corporate income tax rates in the world. Just to give you an idea of where we rank worldwide, and this information doesn't come from IAC, we're not just making this stuff up. This actually came from France, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. In terms of the United States, the only Western state that ranks higher than us is California in corporate income tax rate. But we also rank higher than Japan, Germany. Oh, let's see here. France, Australia, United Kingdom, Sweden, Korea, Czech Republic, Poland, the Slovak Republic. We rank higher than all of those when it comes to our corporate income tax rate in the state of Idaho. You don't want to be overlooked simply based off the effective rate of your corporate income tax rate. That is something this legislature needs to start taking very seriously. We're not saying that you have to cut it in the down economy at this point, but we need to start talking about that in a serious manner of looking at our corporate income tax rate because it is too high. Transportation. We will be supporting efforts to expand our transportation system in the state. And we will be supporting efforts to catch up on the maintenance. It's a lot cheaper to maintain your system than it is to replace it. And we will be supporting those efforts to increase the fuel tax as well as the fees that are out there because it's necessary to catch up on the backlog of maintenance that already exists. Our organization firmly believes that we need to be able to have a stable and effective transportation to get our products to market as well as getting our employees to work. Without a transportation system that works, neither do we. Water, lifeblood of the state. Idaho has a unique opportunity to support the Comprehensive Aquifer Management Plan. There is I've been involved in this, in the organization that came up with this. Now, understand, I represent spring users, surface users, power interests, you name it, sitting around the table. So I don't get to say a lot with sitting around the table, but I can tell you that I was impressed and amazed at the amount of leadership sitting around that table that were able to come to the agreement as far as they have come to this particular point. Part of what they are trying to accomplish in phase one is a 300,000 acre foot change to the Eastern Snake Plain Aquifer annual water budget over the next 10 years. That requires a commitment from the state of about $3 million a year. We support that effort. The users will pick up the rest. I'm not saying that everything's perfect, and I'm not saying that everything has been resolved, but I got to tell you, if we can accomplish this, this is a model for the water wars that will eventually come to Western Idaho, as well as those that have already started in Northern Idaho, as a way that we can point out, yes, we can come to a resolution in this state, and we can solve our water problems to ensure that this aspect of our infrastructure continues to be used effectively. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's my presentation. Hopefully we gave you some information about where we expect things to go, give you some ideas on how we think you can help improve the situation over the next year. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. LeBeau. Committee, please keep in mind our schedule. If there are any questions at this time for Mr. LeBeau, Senator LaFavor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's really quick. Alex, you had mentioned you were supportive of transportation, and I was wondering, you mentioned employees' work. Are you going to be supporting funding for public transportation or local option?
Mr. Newell.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Faber, our position on local option is we do not oppose it under specific circumstances.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Mr. Lowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Committee, our next presentation, Doug Benson, Chief Economist for Idaho Transportation Department. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Benson. The floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. As I make sure I've got the technology down here, I'll proceed. I am Doug Benson, for the record, economist of the Idaho Transportation Department. I'll be talking a little bit today on revenue to the highway distribution account and forecasts that I've made on revenue to that specific account. Left button? Oh, there we go. Okay. Got to be trained on technology really quickly. This first chart that I've got up here shows what has gone on in gasoline prices and oil prices over the last 5 years. We've all seen and panicked during the time since middle of 2007 on gasoline prices shooting up to $4 a gallon area in the state of Idaho. You'll notice Idaho, the blue line shows, the red line following the national line fairly closely in fuel prices. The last time when I made presentations to other areas, my biggest concern was the big disparity between oil prices and gasoline prices, how quickly they'd gone up. And now oil prices are now down back into the area where they seem more reasonable with the overall oil prices. I just showed this chart just simply to give an idea of what's going on. We are now down in fuel prices down to where we were in 2004. If you'd asked me 6-8 months ago, I was trying to sell my pickup and nobody'd buy. So this next chart is just a representation of the sources of revenue that come into the highway distribution account. You'll notice that the two big areas, 67% of the revenue coming in from gasoline taxes and special fuel taxes. When I talk special fuel taxes, that's basically diesel, but it also includes some LNG, some liquefied natural gas, propane, some of the more exotic fuels at a certain point in time, hydrogen can be considered under that special fuel. So because it's an on-the-road fuel. So should a time ever come that we really have a hydrogen plant or a hydrogen car in the state, that would be available to the state of Idaho. You'll notice that with our big, large dependence on fuel as a revenue source, the increasing miles per gallon for cars, the increased use of hybrid cars, the increased use of more efficient trucks, more efficient use of loading trucks creates a downward pressure on revenue. At the same time, there's an increased use on the roads. The vehicle miles of travel increasing somewhat, but there's a greater demand upon highways in the state. And although cars and truck, when I say car and small truck registrations, these are basically registrations at the county level, the passenger cars, the small trucks, the small farm vehicles at the state level. Although they only generate 16% of the revenue to the state in a time when where we are age-based vehicles and people are now buying less new vehicles and keeping my older vehicle considerably longer, that has a downward pressure on revenue to the highway distribution account also. The other two areas, basically commercial truck registration. Those are the big rigs, over 26 and over 60,000 pounds, in-state and out-of-state registrations. The miscellaneous fees to the highway distribution account include driver's licenses, some miscellaneous plate fees, and some other small miscellaneous items that come in, representing only 2% of revenue to the highway distribution account. The highway distribution account by law is then distributed according to this formula. 38% going to local units of government, 5% to the Idaho State Police, and 57% to the Idaho Transportation Department. This just gives you an idea of how the money goes through and how it is divided through the highway distribution account. Now we kind of get to the meat of the matter that we're talking about. You'll notice this chart showing historically back to 1996 revenue to the highway distribution account. You'll notice there's a slight jump or a jump up between 96 and 97. That is when the registration fees and the fuel tax increase actually came into the account and started into the account. We suffered a slowdown, a drop from 2001 to 2005 in revenue that actually took us almost to 2007 to come back to 2001 levels. And 2007, as I see it right now, is going to be the good year. It's going to be the good old times, good old days. We currently see revenue coming in significantly lower. Now, this is my August of 08 forecast. Give you an idea, on my forecasting cycle, usually what I do is in August, in preparing for the governor's presentation and governor's budget setting, I will make the forecast in August of each year. Each month, we monitor the monthly allocations of those forecasts to see how we're doing in relative to that forecast. Barring anything unforeseen, in November, I will reforecast prior to the legislative session in case there's some major change of revenue to the highway distribution account, because this gives local units of government, the Idaho State Police, time to plan for any changes that may come at that point. Then in April, after the legislative session, we count the dead and wounded and prepare for, you know, the next forecast should a change need to be made on towards the end of the fiscal year in our forecast. The next slide I've got here is kind of an idea of what's gone on over the last four forecasts that I've made. In August of 07, and I'm going to kind of concentrate on 9 and 10 right now in revenue, I had forecast revenues of the highway distribution account of $204.6 million and $205.6 million. Subsequent forecasts, you can see what my forecasts have changed over time. In the latest forecast, we're showing probably between a 9 and 11% decline in revenue to the highway distribution account between the two August forecasts. Now, and you'll notice that what I've got on that slide is based on what I've just seen through December. I'm honestly looking at dropping that forecast probably another $5 to $6 million per year for 9 and 10. I will, as soon as the governor's forecast of the state economy is available, I will rerun my models and reforecast that information. But it looks as if that is going to be the case. The reason December is important, revenue to the highway distribution account from the gasoline and diesel lags by 2 months. So we're actually seeing the revenue of October coming in December, because the way the dealers, distributors have a reporting, they've got till the end of the next month after to report their actual report and submit their actual receipts. So there's a 2 month lag there usually, because they're going to wait till the last possible minute to send it in, and it, by the time it's processed, it's a two-month lag. An interesting thing that, you know, ITD, the legislature sets ITD's budget, and that's exactly appropriate, but in we cannot spend more than we're taking in. You could set our budget right now at $205.6 million, and our department is not going to be able to pay spend more than the, I anticipate, something like $176 million that we actually receive. Management every month is meeting and deciding on changing what needs to be done. On payouts of projects, they can take over a long period of time. So the board and management has to look out a long way to assure that there's money in the bank to pay for all the projects that are coming through the pipeline. One of the questions that was asked by the committee is what's driving my forecast. And I would have been happy days about the fuel prices dropping like they are, because I would assume then I could drive my big pickup more. People right now are now becoming more concerned about jobs, just basic employment, keeping up with anything. So that's reducing travel right now. There's an interesting thing, they were calling them, staycations, where you stay at home and have a vacation at home. Instead of having the great number of out-of-state visitors and people coming in from other states, people are staying closer to home. And like that. Also, we've had, and I call it severe weather. This is, I guess, an average year for snowfall, except in Spokane, northern Idaho. I call it severe weather, but I don't drive as much. I don't go see my children in Idaho Falls near as much, and it's like that. Again, it's people staying closer to home. And in my forecast and everything that I've looked at, I don't see anything improving for the next 1 to 2 years in revenue coming into the highway distribution account. As I look at, and I just looked this morning, and it was mentioned that jobless claims, first-time jobless claims nationally, are level or falling slightly at 467,000 claims, but the continuing jobless claims are at a 26-year high. And I assume that that's probably the same in the state of Idaho. I haven't seen any specific information for the state of Idaho. But I assume that Idaho's not doing any magnificent work. So, Mr. Chairman, that is my presentation, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Committee questions, Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Benson. I'm curious about what assumptions you use about gas prices and miles traveled in your forecast. I saw an article that talked about in the U.S. in general, there was 1 billion miles less driven last year, and the gas prices are going to rebound in another year or two, maybe back up to $4 a gallon or more. Have you factored those in as part of the forecast, or how do you, what assumptions are you using there?
Mr. Benson.
Representative Saylor, in my forecast, I'm actually using Idaho employment, Idaho non-agricultural employment, as one of the bases for my forecast for the state of Idaho. That's the reason I'm waiting for Mr. Ferguson, DFM, to come out with their forecast. I don't use vehicle miles of travel either nationally or locally because, to be quite honest, vehicle miles of travel in Idaho and in other states are based upon fuel consumption and estimates anyway. So I would use that to get some questionable area.
Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Benson, you mentioned there's a two-month lag between the receipt, reporting and receipt of the funds. Is there any reason why that couldn't be reduced?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Killen. That is the way that it's set up by the Tax Commission. It gives the distributors a chance to complete and close their books on anything that's not taxable or is shipped out of state that shouldn't be taxable for Idaho purposes. And what happens is they've got till the end of the next month to report. December receipts have got to be reported at the end of January. But anybody that's an accountant, I'm sure, is going to wait till the last possible second to make sure the check flops over to the next month. business practices.
I see no further questions. Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Vinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Committee, we're just a little behind. We'll take a break now, and we will start promptly at 10:25, so if we could all please keep track of the time. Thank you.